October 31st, Halloween. The festival that became known as Halloween was once the most important festival of the year for people over much of Europe. Although it's primarily a children's holiday today, many of the traditional customs and associations are reflected in the form of the modern holiday. In pre-Christian times, Halloween marked the beginning not only of winter, but of the new year. It was the time when all cattle were to be gathered in, all crops harvested. It also, above all, was a festival of the dead, who were thought of very differently than in modern times, and a period of great supernatural activity. People believed that the dead, all the dead, the good and the bad alike, could return and become active at this time, along with a whole range of supernatural creatures from major gods to minor imps and spirits of all kinds. But in all truth, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, I care not for the origins of this holiday, of trick and treating, of hobgobbling from door to door with childish delight, laughing and giggling over bits of candy placed in sacks. No, for me, Halloween is a time to delve into the far reaches of time and the mind of man, to encounter one of the great delights of the occasion. You may join me if you like, or you may turn your dial and placate your mind with soothing music, or you may turn your radio off and enjoy restful conversation. But if you stay with me, I should like to warn you, you will never be the same again. For what you are about to hear will chill the very marrow of your bones. So if you like, draw the curtains, turn the light low, and come with me as we present Ghost Story. I pass this narrative on to you with my full consent to your making of it whatever you choose. With one reservation, please do not give my real name and address should you publish it. I do not desire to be bombarded with letters from critics, either friendly or adverse. I wish to pursue the tenor of my way without embarrassing publicity. During that unforgettable period between 1914 and 1918, I saw many things like a little knowledge would incline a man's mind to atheism, did that man happen to be an orthodox religionist to begin with. Without being irreverent, I sometimes think that not only man, but God is in the making. I would like to expound this doctrine at greater length, but lack of time forbids. So let us put theology and metaphysics and the rest aside, though beyond doubt, we have to get back to them sooner or later. Now, for the incident. Whilst I was stationed at a certain village behind the firing line, I became acquainted with a very interesting fellow who had made a special study of the occult. His name was Greers. He was a bombing officer, but not a bit like an officer of the old school. I have never been more than a humble sergeant, yet Greer's treatment of me was at all times most genial and pleasant in every way. We were great pals, I can tell you. Greer's belonged to one of the big spiritualistic societies, though exactly which I can't remember. At any rate, he was certainly very well versed in the subject, and I feel sure he was just the kind of man who would make a good medium. Not that he was nervy or highly strung, not he, but he seemed to sense everything that was going on in the air. You know what I mean. Some of his premonitions were astonishingly reliable. And alas, in the end, his presentiment as to his own fate was all too true. He was killed by a sniper just a couple of days before he should have gone home on leave. But that isn't my story. One glorious summer's evening, when the moon was at full, and yes, the nightingales were singing rapturously in some parts of the wood, as had escaped shellfire, Greers and I went on a stroll. We were not feeling exactly in good spirits. In fact, we were both decidedly fed up. The end of the dreadful war seemed as far off as ever. We'd been trying to convince ourselves and each other that the affair couldn't possibly last much longer, but recent developments had shown that optimism may sometimes be but the measure of despair. We walked along in gloomy silence, busy with our own unhappy reflections, we wended our way towards a wood. Perhaps these warbling blighters will buck us up a bit, said Greer's, alluding to the nightingales. Though I doubt it. I suppose I was cynical, too. I don't know, I replied. But I'm inclined to think they'll make us worse. It's the memories they bring back, you know. Oh, damn you and your memories, Greer's exclaimed impatiently. You start being sentimental, I'm certainly going back. It would be more cheerful in a dugout. He laughed, a bitter sort of laugh, not good to hear. Frankly, I had never known poor Greer's to get so low. Happily, I had the good sense not to refer to the nightingales again, and he went on. Soon we came to a fence and climbed over it into the wood. As we entered, the bird stopped singing. Our boots made such a noise amongst the fallen branches, and more than that, Greer's, forcing himself to appear less miserable, broke into song. Not exactly a hearty, happy song, but a broken, unmelodious sort of dirge, jerked out in a peculiarly strident falsetto voice. If you're going to make those queer sounds like that, I said, I guess it's Oyle who'll be quitting. Whereupon we both laughed. Without aspiring to punstership, if there be such a word, we may take it that we're now at quits, said Greer's. Then he lapsed again into silence. We went deeper into the wood. It was an uncanny sort of place, full of mysterious light and shadow. We traversed a long, dark aisle of trees and came out into a peaceful glade flooded with moonlight, and it was here that we received the surprise of our lives. Coming toward us across the open glade was the figure of a girl, or rather the figure of a girl complete as far as the waist. We stood still. Greer's uttered an oath. I felt nervous and clutched his arm. I could feel a tremor running through him. He gasped. The astounding object came nearer, floating through the air at about the same height at which it would have been if the rest of the body were present. It was supernaturally bright, brighter even than the moonlight, a pure shining white. I had never seen anything like it. A ghost, I whispered, my voice seeming to come from a vast distance. Greer's nodded. He was peering at the apparition intently. His arm was no longer trembling. I suppose he must have imparted something of the fearless scientific attitude toward me. I, too, gazed with intensest interest upon the amazing figure. It drew quite close. We could see it now in some detail, a finely proportioned feminine form, but cut short at the waist. Clearly visible were the head, face, shoulders, and breasts. The breasts were prominent, but below the waist was nothing. Speak to her, I said to Greer's. My companion's lips were framed for speech, and he held out a hand as if in welcome. But even as he did so, the phantom vanished. We searched diligently. It had vanished completely. But we did find something, something dreadful in the extreme. Greer's was prying under a bush about 20 yards from where the ghost had been when he stretched out his hand. As he moved aside a branch, he suddenly drew back, uttering a cry of horror. I ran to his side, inquiring what was the matter. Pale as death and shaking like an aspen, he led me to the spot and drew aside the leafy boughs so I could see. There, lying stretched upon the mossy ground, was part of a female body, the lower part, from the waist downwards. It showed conspicuously in the moonlight. I touched it, said Greer's in an unsteady voice. It was awful. We examined the mutilated remains more closely. Decomposition had begun. I cannot say more. Only they were long strings of jagged flesh and skin, and a piece of backbone projected hideously. Even the memory of this thing is dreadful. We withdrew, filled with nausea, and dominated by emotions that could find relief only in rapid motion. Until we had left the wood well behind us, neither of us spoke a word. And the explanation? All I can say is this. Greer's, being an officer, had access to information not then available to those of inferior ranks. He told me later that previous to our occupation, the enemy had wrought havoc amongst the female population of this particular district. They were known to have ravished girls and women and then slain them in cold blood. Then, it was reported, some of them, the most brutal and perverted of them, had actually dismembered their victims. And in at least one instance, a girl's body had been cut in two. Greers declared that as a student of the occult, he was inclined to associate the last mentioned deed of brutal violence with the apparition we had seen in the glade. And the gruesome relics found beneath the bush certainly seemed to substantiate his theory. There is a slim, long gravestone on the American side of Niagara Falls commemorating those who met their deaths in one of the most horrific ways known to man in the raging whirlpool which eddies eternally below the falling cliffs of water. Some of the names on the stone are of men who died by accident. Others flung themselves over the falls for fleeting fame or money. For others, it was a way out of black despair. A few of them lived for a little while. But Patrick Neil Thompson was not among that elite band. He fell over the Niagara Falls one winter night in 1940 and was never seen again. At least, not alive. But how he reappeared 2 years later when his son Kenneth was beyond any human aid is the story that people who live and work within the thunder of the falls still remember and still tell. Patrick Thompson was a civil engineer. He lived with his wife and son in the small village of Hamstone on the Canadian side of Niagara Falls. In the late 1930s, the Rainbow Bridge, an ancient suspension bridge connecting the American and Canadian shore some miles upriver, had been swept away by ice packs. The company employing Thompson won the major contract to build a new one. And so work began in 1939. By January 1940, the main piles had been sunk and concrete was being pumped around the major buttresses. Patrick Thompson was in charge of a team of 10 men working on a scaffold platform in midstream. It was priority work. The Canadians would soon be at war. Supplies and machinery bought from America poured into Ontario. Every bridge was needed. The Rainbow Bridge men worked in shifts around the clock to throw a span across the river. Patrick Thompson and his men found themselves working regular night shifts under floodlights mounted on scaffolding and derricks. On the night of January 17th, Thompson was supervising concrete being unloaded from a barge into a hopper on the rig. A near gale force wind was lashing up from Lake Erie, building the waves on the Niagara River into near ocean proportions. The string of barges in the darkness below banged and rattled against the rig. Thompson stood guiding the crane bucket into the hopper. Suddenly the wind caught the crane jib and whipped it savagely to the right. The bucket, at about chest height, caught Thompson, knocking him off the platform into the churning water below. 5 miles downstream, the falls were waiting. He must have been unconscious or semi-conscious from the blow because they heard no sound. Boats put out and searchlights raked the water, but Patrick Thompson was never seen again. An inquest returned a verdict of death by drowning. The coroner expressed sympathy for his widow and son. The company said they were sorry to lose such a fine man. Patrick Thompson died the day before his birthday. He would have been 32 years of age. Doris Thompson went back to Hamstone and took a job in the office of a building firm. Her son Kenneth, now 10, was at a local school. 2 years went by. An insurance policy payment, a small pension from her husband's employers, and her own salary enabled the mother and son to have a pleasant life. She was still young, under 30, and a very eligible widow. It looked as though the pair would recover pretty well from the blow fate had dealt them. But fate, it seemed, had not yet done itself out with the Thompson family. In the first week of April 1942, Kenneth and two friends were on the bank of the Niagara River. The spring thaw had swollen it into a mile-wide torrent. The boys watched with awe as huge uprooted trees bucketed past in the grip of relentless currents. They threw small branches into the water and saw them skirl away toward the distant roar of the falls. Suddenly, Kenny Thompson, overwhelmed by enthusiasm for the game, grasped a large bough and tossed it over the bank. With a scream, he overbalanced and toppled into the stream himself. His two friends watched transfixed as the boy was whirled away. Incredibly, he did not drown. He clung to the branch, which, bobbing and rearing like a macabre steed, bore him steadily to destruction. His friends, shocked into action, ran to their bicycles and made for the nearest telephone. The watermen at Horseshoe Falls prepared their boats and lifelines, but it was largely a token gesture. Water at least 40 feet thick was hurling itself over the 400-foot-high curve of rock. Spray lashed hundreds of feet into the air. No human life could exist amid such fury. Meantime, Kenneth, on the last bend before the falls, felt the branch on which he rode accelerate like a powerful car. Semi-conscious with fear, he struggled to keep his head above water. His numb fingers slipped off the bark and the branch jerked free of him. Kenneth Thompson sank deeply into the blinding waters and knew in his heart that he would never rise again. But he did. Straight ahead, he could see the semicircular outline of the edge of the falls and knew the end was only seconds away. And then it happened. 23 years later, Kenneth Thompson remembers every detail of those next incredible sounds. He felt arms closing around his shoulders. No longer was he drifting helplessly on the current. He could feel the water surging against him. But he was no longer moving. Firmly held by some unknown, unseen force, he began to move toward the bank. Then he heard the voice. It was low, soft, and heartbreakingly familiar. It said, "Hold on to me, and don't be afraid. I'll take care of you." It was the voice of his father. Of that, Kenneth Thompson has no doubt, nor has he any doubt that some tangible presence supported him on that 100-yard fight against the current and helped him up the bank to safety. Because, you see, Kenneth Thompson cannot swim. Stories of hauntings must run into dozens, if not hundreds of thousands, and they stretch back to the beginnings of recorded history. Supposing that 80% of these tales and legends can be written off to imagination, hallucination, embroidery of perfectly normal happenings, and just plain lies, there still remains a highly impressive residue of quite indisputable ghost stories for which there is no normal explanation. England and Scotland seem to have a particularly rich crop of hauntings, most famous perhaps as Glamis Castle, the ancestral home of the Queen Mother. Of the many stories connected with it, including that of the Earl who gambled with the devil, the best known probably does not concern a haunting at all. It is the story of the hidden room of which no one knows but the Earl, his heir, and his bailiff. Mischievous attempts have been made to find the room, but none has been successful. We shall probably never know the nature of the occupant of that living tomb. Whether it be ghostly or of flesh and blood, as some say, it demands our pity rather than our horror. If there is any truth in some of the more ghastly of the conjectures which have been made, then our deepest sympathy must be for Earl and Eyre, and for the inmate of that fearful room. And yet it may well be that the whole story of the dark, impenetrable secret is but the invention of some too lively imagination which remembers that a Thane of Glamis once let himself be led over the abyss of infamy by the weird sisters who practiced a deed without a name. One of the commonest types of haunting is the ghostly coach, sometimes with headless horses, which is said to drive up to certain houses when a death in the family is near. Wicked Will Darrow, who flourished in the reign of Elizabeth I, is said to drive his coach up to his former manor at Littlecote in Wiltshire, just before the death of an heir. The last time he is recorded to have done this was in 1861, when the heir of Francis Popham, then the owner, was lying at death's door. The nurse, having sent for the boy's parents, was not surprised to hear the carriage arrive late at night. But when no sound was heard after it had stopped, and no parents appeared, the nurse looked out. The bright moonlight shone upon an empty drive. The parents arrived next day, after the boy had died. The origin of this haunting is as follows. During his lifetime, Wicked Will kept a mistress at Littlecote. One night, Mrs. Barnes, the local midwife, was roused from her sleep. A hooded figure seized her when she opened the door, set her behind him on a horse, and galloped off furiously through the dark with his captive. At last they reached a darkened house where Mrs. Barnes was taken to a room and told to perform her office. As soon as the babe was delivered, Wicked Will seized it and flung it in the fire, roaring in the hearth. Mrs. Barnes was well paid and hurried back to her cottage. But the good lady's conscience would not let her rest. Dark as the night had been, she was certain that it was Littlecote that she had visited, and accordingly she laid her information. The trial of Wicked Will made a sensation, and the accused narrowly escaped being lynched by the angry mob. He also escaped being hanged, an escape which public rumor connected with the fact that the Attorney General, Sir John Popham, soon afterwards became the owner of Littlecote. He was the ancestor of Francis Popham. Wicked Will, it is said, was haunted by the ghost of the burning babe, and finally met his death when his horse, startled by the apparition, threw him with such violence that he broke his neck. Another family ghost is the drummer of Cortachy in Scotland, which is said to be heard beating his drum before a member of the Ogilvy family dies. London has its fair share of hauntings and more. Anyone who wanted to sample all the haunted rooms and houses in the metropolis would have his work cut out for him. One would forgive him if he were to decide to give the famous haunted house in Berkeley Square a miss. The house still stands on the west side of the square, but it would be indiscreet to mention the number. It was in the winter of 1962-1963 that our next story takes place. The streets of London were heavy with snow and slush and ice. The night was one of those in which the temperature seemed to change almost from hour to hour, so that one moment you would be treading on ice as hard as rock of ages, at another your boot would squelch into a pool of soggy slush. Indeed, it almost seemed as if one were living between two worlds, one of the Arctic bitterness and the other of even more penetrating, chilly dampness. Two stranded sailors, their money spent on liquid fuel to warm their internal mechanism, who wandered through Berkeley Square that evening looking for shelter that they would not have to pay for, were shortly to find themselves, in very truth, the inhabitants of two worlds. "Look, Bill," said one, "Austerlitz." They were indeed standing before the gaunt and empty mansion whose evil repute had for years been left untenanted. It did not take long for them to break in, climb a harshly protesting staircase, and discover a large room which was empty except for an enormous bedstead. For some reason, perhaps because the owners thought they were tainted, the covers had been left on the bed. True, they were moth-eaten and almost falling to pieces, but to the two sailors they offered at least some protection from the marrow freezing cold. Prowling around, they found a few worm-eaten sticks of furniture, and soon a fire was alight in a grate. The contrast made the room seem almost more cold, for again and again two men shivered as they crouched beside a blaze which seemed to make no headway against a chill more bitter even than the outside. "Better get onto the covers. Maybe they'll keep us warm a bit." For a while it seemed as if Bill was right, and before long the two men slept. Quite suddenly, both were awake. Their very bones seemed to be afire with cold.
"Did you hear something, Bill?"
The other nodded. What they heard was something ascending the stairs. By no stretch of the imagination could they have been human footsteps, nor could they have been made by a cat or a dog. They were heavy, like the feet of some kind of great animal, stealthy, as if made by some inmate of a streaming tropical jungle. But the most horrifying thing about them was that they squelched, as if whatever made them was some monstrous befooted reptile. The same impulse made both men spring out of bed in a moment and rush to the window. The action was purely instinctive. Both men were certain, as they had never been certain of anything before, that nothing in heaven or earth would induce them to face the horror which now loomed in the doorway. Moreover, one of them had placed a stout cudgel, which he had with him by the window. These men had faced danger often enough, with no more than a healthy fear of whatever understandable peril was before them. Now there was something which made them understand the meaning of having their bones turned to water, and it emanated from the thing in the doorway. Still, they could make out neither shape nor form, but a vile stench came from the whimpering, slobbering apparition, which was the very smell of fear itself. Bill, who had armed himself with a cudgel, stood astraddle before the window while his companion pressed against the wall beside him as if he would force his way through it. Both men were on the verge of insanity from utter terror of this unknown, inexplicable thing. Suddenly, the whimpering ceased. There was a plop and a scrabble as some frog-like creature with horny claws, and the thing precipitated itself at the man with a club. Bill jerked backwards. There was a crashing of glass and rotten slats, a wild scream, and a moment later, Bill lay with a broken neck on the concrete below. Uttering scream after scream, his companion leaped through the door, flew down the stairs, as one sometimes does in dreams, tore or smashed open the front door, and collapsed unconscious on the stone steps. There, a short while later, a policeman found him. When at last he could speak, his almost incoherent story guided the officer to the spot where the body of Bill lay. I cannot guarantee that things happened exactly as I have told them, but the story has gained widespread credence and is to be met with again and again. Whether there was in the haunted room something evil which sparked off hallucinations in the minds of those who slept there, whether there are indeed some non-human creatures which attach themselves to certain places, I do not know, and I have no explanation to make of such stories as these. However, I do believe that there are levels of existence other than the human or animal, and there is much evidence which suggests that these levels occasionally impinge upon our own. Perhaps a mathematician with an understanding of other dimensions could find some sort of answer.
You are listening to the visual sounds of Mike Worf. Please press fast forward, let side one expire, and turn tape over for part two of Ghost Story.
Thank you.
In his fascinating ghost book, Shane Leslie has a somewhat similar story to the one we just related, which goes back for centuries, of a ghost which was seldom seen, but made itself felt with a sense of such vivid terror that it was the cause of many suicides by perfectly happy and normal people. By special authorization of a Roman Catholic bishop, it was at last successfully exorcised. A much happier type of haunting filled the Paris press almost 200 years ago. It also forms part of Robert Dale Owen's The Debatable Land Between This World and the Next, published in 1871. Dale Owen, son of Robert Owen, the Welsh social reformer, was taken to the United States with his family when a boy, and later became a member of the House of Representatives and then U.S. Minister to Italy. He was one of the drafters of the bill founding the Smithsonian Institution. This is the story told to him to the Paris press and also recorded in the New York Nation. Monsieur N.G. Bach, music teacher, pianist, and composer, great-grandson of Johann Sebastian, was delighted when his son Leon bought for him a beautiful spinet of the 16th century. Close examination showed it to have been made by Antonio Nobili in 1564. The same night, Monsieur Bach was in bed when he saw, or dreamed that he saw, a young man in the dress of a French courtier of the early 17th century, though doubtless he did not thus identify it immediately. The young man politely informed him that he was a favorite of Henry III and had often played the newly acquired spinet for the amusement of his master. He then sat himself at the spinet and played and sang a plaintive little air, which he said the king had composed, promising that he would find the means to preserve this melody for the new owner. All this might well have been a dream. The one unaccountable fact was that when Monsieur Bach woke in the morning, he found the song neatly written out, words and music, on a sheet of music manuscript. But although some other musical jottings of his own were there, this was clearly not his own, for the script was archaic and nothing like those other jottings. Words and music were certainly those that the young man had played and sung the previous night. Monsieur Bach was a down-to-earth type and did not believe in the supernatural. The only possible explanation was that he had transcribed the song in a state of somnambulism. Nevertheless, the story was too good to keep hidden from his friends. In no time, his home was invaded by musicians and poets and antiquarians anxious to see the mysterious manuscript, and each with his own theory of its origin. Finally, he was persuaded to lend the spinet to a museum, where thousands came to see it after having read the strange story in the newspaper. Charming as this story is, it would have no particular significance if it were not for the sequel. While the spinet was still in the museum, Monsieur Bach found himself one day scribbling unconsciously on a piece of paper. In fact, he fell into a trance and was obviously indulging in what is now called automatic writing. When he came to, he was amazed to find that he had written a letter which was signed Baldassarini, stating that the writer had hidden in a small niche in the spinet a quatrain which his master, King Henry, had written. Greatly excited, Monsieur Bach and his son sent for the spinet from the museum, prized it open, and in the place indicated found a quatrain which closely resembled the four lines which Monsieur Bach had written out in trance. Examination of some genuine scripts of Henry III convinced the experts that the quatrain was indeed in his hand. Tiny holes at the edge of the parchment confirmed that it had been nailed to the case, as was recorded in Monsieur Bach's automatic writing. One point puzzled Monsieur Bach and the experts. In the Henry III manuscript was an interpolated ma, M-A. For a long time, no one could understand this until another message from Baldassarini by Monsieur Bach's hand explained it. Amico mio, the king joked about my Italian accent in the verse he sent with my spinet. I always said ma, M-A, instead of may, M-A-I-S. This indeed is a common error of Italians. In this whole story was one big hoax. It certainly deceived some of the smartest intellects of the materialistic 19th century and must have cost the box a small fortune and incalculable ingenuity. And so this is Halloween. And on Halloween night, we watch our children merrily stroll away from home for Beggar's Night. Urban and commercialized ways of celebrating Halloween. But it was not always so. There was a time when Halloween was a festival of the dead and a period of great supernatural activity. Along with a whole range of supernatural creatures who existed either in the mind or in the real world of man. This has been handed down to us in the form of ghost stories. And the stories that we presented were but a sampling of authenticated, documented stories that are to be found in books on the bookshelves of the world. Provocative and challenging as to make the thinking listener ask just how firmly we are rooted in scientific reality after all. It is to be expected that there are those who scoff or deny the existence of supernatural occurrences, since this is far easier for them than it is to provide adequate, sensible answers. But nonetheless, we have proven, or at least presented, that it is possible to be a guide on a safari deep into the bizarre world of ordinary men and women who have suddenly been confronted by the extraordinary. For those daring enough to satisfy their curiosity about the unexplained mysteries of the human mind and the strange and uncanny side of existence, this program was a trip guaranteed to shake up old conceptions and expand horizons to still unmapped frontiers. Beyond the imagination, beyond the uncharted borderline, for the listener, was the ghost story.